This is Cactus 1539. It burns through Lost Trust and both engines returning back towards LaGuardia.
January the 15th, 2009. And a miracle was taking place on the Hudson River in New York City.
We're unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
A passenger jet that had just taken off from the city's LaGuardia airport had hit a flock of Canada geese, knocking out both of its engines.
Does he need assistance?
Yes, it was a bird strike. Can I get him in for runway 1?
Runway 1, that's good.
Cactus 1529, turn right 280, you can land runway 1 at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
But as air traffic control tried desperately to help the pilot avoid crashing in the middle of the city...
Oh, I think he said he was going in the Hudson.
Another less obvious but equally remarkable event was about to take place in the same spot. One that for sure didn't involve risk to human life, but which would turn out to have an effect far beyond that day on the Hudson River.
The captain went on the speaker and basically said that there was a plane in the Hudson and that we're going to go in and rescue people.
Yanis Krums had just finished work and was heading home on a commuter ferry.
I still to this day remember how quiet it was. There were just people on both wings. We approached one of the wings to be able to start pick people up. And there was one baby that I remember was crying. Otherwise, everyone just kind of was in shock of just because they were freezing and just from the crash. So they were just seeing this ferry come up to them and trying to pick him up.
Now, you took a picture at that exact moment, I think. Was that right?
I took it through the ferry window as we were approaching on one of the sides. Only took one photo and actually posted it on Twitter. There's a plane in the Hudson. I'm on the ferry to pick up the people. Crazy.
As everybody now knows, it's even been the subject of a Hollywood movie. The pilot, Chesley Sullenberger, managed to bring the plane down in the middle of the Hudson, saving the lives of the 155 people on board.
And I remember just giving my gloves and hat and things away because the people were standing in knee-deep water, which was freezing. And so they were just coming in and shaking, and so we were trying to give anything we had that was warm to the people that were coming off the plane.
For the next 30 minutes or so, Yanis was involved with helping passengers being lifted aboard the ferry. But when he looked again at his phone, it was pulsing with Twitter messages from around the world. A simple click on his smartphone would produce a reaction that he couldn't have imagined. What do you think it was about that picture, your tweet, that really caught the imagination?
Well, I think it's probably a combination. It was the plane floating in the Hudson being this kind of real-time event. I was able to capture something that had just happened before anybody else. And it's being New York, and then also beating every media company to it.
Within minutes, the picture that Yanis tweeted of the semi-submerged plane had found its way into news bulletins, websites and papers around the world and transformed Twitter from a place where friends would catch up on what they'd done the night before to a medium that could lead and shape the global conversation.
That was really mind-blowing to me that I could know about and even get photos of and hear from the real-life experiences of people that were on this plane or watching from the sidelines as this real-time event was happening. That was really what made me become such a big Twitter advocate.
Caleb Gardner was a marketing rookie in those days. But by 2013, he was running social media campaigns for Barack Obama. And he never forgot the raw, direct power of Yanis's tweet.
Back then, it was important because the news is often filtered through what they want you to hear about. So you unintentionally kind of get filtered through the lens of the news outlets that you are actually following. Whereas on Twitter, you kind of cut out the middleman and got the real-time responses from the people actually experiencing that event.
That tweet from the Hudson River was the start of a process that made Twitter central to the flow of news and information on which so much politics is based. An early sign of the real potential of the platform, and one which it quickly embraced.
We exist to serve the public conversation, and our priority as a company is improving the health of that public conversation.
Nick Pickles is senior strategist for public policy at Twitter.
What Twitter brings is it brings a unique place for a public conversation to happen between those at the top of government and everybody else in society. So it can be a conversation between two prime ministers, or it can be a conversation between two constituents and their local member of parliament. that unique role that Twitter brings doesn't detract from all of those other conversations. It adds to it. And I think one of the exciting things for me, as we look at a world where politics and democracy is being discussed more than it ever has in my lifetime, is we do have a place where we can speak truth to power.
Those are big, ambitious claims, but they ring true with many participants in the 24-hour swirl that our politics and media have now become.
All breaking news comes out through Twitter now. All major statements from the government, from the opposition, every major event is now on Twitter before it is anywhere else. Before any breaking news on the BBC or Sky or anywhere else, it is on Twitter. And if I want to keep abreast of breaking news, I have to be following a Twitter feed of the people who are there on the scene.
Political journalist and presenter for Talk Radio, Julia Hartley Brewer, couldn't do her job without Twitter now. Nor, it turns out, could our politicians, even ones, how can I put this, as old school as veteran MP Sir Nicholas Soames.
Do you think it would be possible to be a politician today in Britain without being on Twitter?
No. It's very, very difficult to get your views in an increasingly badly reported political world. The only way that I have of getting that out, really, is through the avenues that are open to me myself, i.e. Twitter. And, I quite often get things of journalists ringing me up saying, I see you said this, that and the other. So to that extent, it's valuable.
It has been absolutely huge in terms of democratising our ability to find out what people have said. Well, this is what someone said. Well, no, it's not. Here's the audio. Here's a video of them saying it. Here's my analysis of it. Here's what someone else is saying. And the rebuttal that comes so quickly, it has now moved our news on so fast that a story can begin and have a middle and end within an hour, whereas that probably used to take a week. Maybe a few years ago it took a day, but now it's all over and done within an hour.
So it's clear that Twitter now has a huge role to play in our politics and the way we talk about them. But is that a good thing?
Commercial, tabloidised social media, they are a danger to democracy.
Christian Fuchs, director of the Communication and Media Research Institute at the University of Westminster, thinks not. For him, Twitter is not so much an aid to our public conversation as a threat.
Twitter is not a communication company, it's an advertising company. Yeah? It's all about selling targeted advertising. So it's all about the accumulation of capital, of economic capital, the accumulation of visibility and of followers in the very structure of Twitter itself. It's a kind of quite individualistic platform, therefore it's also not a social medium. You could say it's an anti-social or an individualistic medium. It's all focused on single individuals who try to accumulate lots of attention. On Twitter, communication power is very asymmetrically distributed. So at the moment, the user with the largest number of followers is Katy Perry. She has around 107 million followers. Followed by Justin Bieber with around 105 million followers. So these are celebrities. Or Donald Trump now has around 55 million followers. However, the everyday user of Twitter maybe has around 500 to a maximum of 1,000 followers. So there's a huge asymmetry of communication power there, which does not allow us to speak of a public sphere.
I just don't think that we've had this before, a private company that basically owns an enormous global public space.
The fact that this global political discussion is taking place on a platform that's owned and run by a single private company based in downtown San Francisco also causes concern to Carl Miller, a researcher into social media at the London-based think tank Demos.
Underneath this hugely public network is actually quite a private company, Twitter Inc., full of very well-meaning people, but people who are struggling to understand how, as a private company, they can make decisions which previously only public institutions have made.
And he says the way that Twitter works, where the most outrageous comments seem to get the most attention, is changing the content as well as the tone of the political conversations we have.
It's emotional arousal. It's actually the kind of real lizard part of your brain that's being awoken. And you find yourself sharing it almost before you've even thought about it. And that means that, of course, like because they are the kinds of information which are most likely to be shared and the kind of information most likely to be seen, that's the kind of politics we often get. It's actually politics which is either very funny or very angry, shocking or uplifting. There's little time for emotional as well as factual caveats in political communication, or certainly that's the kind of information that you just don't see.
Is that making our politics worse?
It's making our politics angrier, it's making our politics more polarised.
Caleb Gardner, Barack Obama's former social media manager, agrees.
It has this massive potential to organize people like never before, but it also gives voice to some of the loudest, brashest, most controversial voices in our society. And it's really optimized to do that. We react to things on Twitter because it drives emotion and it kind of plays to our basest instincts in ways that I don't think the platforms themselves have really reconciled with. They aren't looking to take editorial responsibility like a news outlet takes, but they specifically have said things like, we are not a media platform, we are a tech platform that media companies use, because they don't want to be seen as having to have that kind of editorial responsibility.
Twitter acknowledges many of these problems, but it argues it may not all be down to the way the platform works. Nick Pickles, Twitter's senior strategist for public policy.
The soundbite was around long before Twitter was around, and so this idea of having a clear, succinct way of articulating messages isn't something that came around with Twitter. And I think the idea of brevity being something that focuses the mind and makes you really think about the core of what you're trying to say is a good thing in an age where we all have lots of information to digest.
Except some people would probably say something like, it doesn't help to be on the receiving end of those simple messages. Actually, politics is much more nuanced than that.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think one of the challenges for our current generation of politicians is to make the argument for complexity. The issues around technology and society and speech are very complex. And I think in an age where we are moving very quickly, the news cycle moves many, many times a day now, is the idea that complexity is something that we should embrace is more important than ever.
We haven't always, of course, been so worried about Twitter. When it first started to emerge as a political tool, it was seen as a refreshing antidote to what some saw as the impenetrability of politics. Caleb Gardner remembers the excitement amongst Barack Obama's campaign team when people started to see the way Twitter enabled voters and politicians to communicate directly.
It made a difference both in the real-time nature of it, because we could kind of get real-time reactions.
As against waiting for the news cycle or the next news bulletin.
Right, or having the lag time of this just happened in the next 3 days, we're going to, you know, march to your senator's office and tell him that you're upset about it. You could have kind of a real-time reaction to a vote that someone took, for example. And another big thing that happened that we realized in 2013, 2014 is that some of the members of Congress would run their own Twitter account still. I mean, they really didn't have a sophisticated communications operation. And so we found that for certain key House districts, having people that were their constituency reach out to them on Twitter was a more effective communication medium than having them call into their office where the phone lines could be jammed or you could be talking to one of their staff.
Did it make Congress more democratic, do you think, that constituents could speak directly to their representatives in this way?
I think back then it did. There was an underlying feeling for many, many years about feeling like you were getting spun by governments and corporations. And when social media came around, it really realigned those power dynamics. And all of a sudden, we were the powerful ones. We being the users were the powerful ones. And the institutions themselves were trying to appeal to our good nature to be on their side and didn't really have the tool set to be able to do it because they were built for the old world.
Nowhere was this new order seen more than across the Middle East. From 2011 onwards, grassroots protests against decades of authoritarian rule in the region made huge use of Twitter to challenge those in power. In Egypt, activists calling for the downfall of the country's president, Hosni Mubarak, used social media not only to get people out onto the streets, or more exactly into Tahrir Square in Cairo, which had become the centre of their protest, but also to call the world's attention to their cause.
What was energising the crowd was the way in which these social media platforms and Twitter was able to both mobilise people in Egypt to come out, really for one of the first times, against one of the longest-serving despots in the Middle East, but then also how they were able to tell their story to the rest of the world.
Carl Miller, social media researcher at Demos.
Tahrir Square was the beginning of this conflagration of digital protests. It just felt like the political furniture was falling down and that it was going to reform. As Howe was finding these new far less rule-based forms, actually what it was bringing with it was liberation. That's what it looked like in Tahrir Square, and that's what it looked like really for several years. Because after that, we had Gezi Park in Turkey, we had the Occupied movement. It seemed to be bringing a whole brave new world of protest and political mobilisation.
That brave new world turned out to be short-lived, not least because the authorities in many of those countries took control of social media, or even shut it down, and then took direct action to clear the protesters that remained. But as the authorities re-established control, activists such as Jamila Hanan, who's based in Devon in the southwest of England, discovered another powerful use for Twitter. Simply connecting to other people could lead to effective action, regardless of the geographical distance between them.
I'd seen the plight of some Bahraini medics on the television, and I was really shocked by what I saw and decided maybe I could help support a campaign for them. So I did a video message of me just ranting, really, about this is awful, what's happening to these medics, how come they're getting imprisoned just for treating injured protesters. Posted it on Twitter without really thinking much about it, using the Bahrain hashtag.
What had caught Jamila's eye was the case of 47 Bahraini doctors and nurses who'd been imprisoned by the authorities during unrest in the country in 2011.
Most of Bahrain were really active on Twitter. And so overnight, that video just took off, got 3,000 views in a very short space of time. And within days, I was in direct contact and Skyping the medics who had been temporarily released from prison and were campaigning for their freedom. I just realised, wow, this is such a powerful tool that I'm sat here in England, I've got no connection with these people, and straight away I can help them.
And how did it feel to go from a single tweet to becoming such an important force in achieving their liberty?
Really daunting and quite a shock, because one minute you've got a relatively normal life. I'd been active in campaigning on environmental issues in my locality, but they weren't human rights issues. And overnight, I was kind of dropped into another world where people were suffering such terrible abuses. And they seemed so real to me, feeling their fear and thinking, could somebody come and arrest me because I'm involved with them?
At Jamila Hanan now has more than 75,000 followers, many of whom are in a position to make a difference to the causes she espouses.
The type of people who are on Twitter, other than the trolls and other than people just talking about their shopping and daily things, most people who are on there, certainly the ones I'm connected with now, are quite often decision makers, journalists, other activists. They're the people who are able to bring about change. So although you might put something on Facebook and get thousands and thousands of more views, they're not generally really active people, but people who are kind of decision makers, influencers, I find that they're on Twitter.
Jamila has been involved in campaigns for people in Gaza, in Yemen, and most prominently for the Rohingya people in Myanmar. Long before their plight made it to the world's front pages, she was using Twitter to disseminate information that she was receiving from the region about atrocities taking place there.
Reports were coming in so fast, I hardly even had time to tweet about it. It was so chaotic and so awful what was happening that literally all we could do was get the information and write it. I mean, often with tears. I mean, it was just horrific.
What kind of things were you hearing about?
Many, many rapes, accounts of torture, military moving into villages, surrounding the villages, asking for women to be handed over for them to rape, the men having to hide in the jungle at night, knowing that their women were going to be attacked, getting videos of women coming out crying and hearing that this is the translation. They've just killed her baby. They've just thrown her baby on the fire. When it was a really horrific bit of news, I'd pull myself together, put out a tweet saying, this has just happened, this has happened, and that's all I could do.
This information is coming into you.
Yeah.
What did you then do? How did you then use Twitter to put
it
out there?
So what I could do is just link to the shared Google document and pin it to my Twitter profile and say, this is a daily log of what's happening to the Rohingya. Those documents shared on Twitter became a real central source, and I could see people from all over the world constantly logging onto that. And even to this day, I still have journalists coming back and thanking me because they use that as a reference now to verify information. If they get a report today and somebody says, in 2017, I was in this village and this happened, they can go back to that document and they can see the links and the videos that were coming out on that day.
How do you feel knowing the power of that particular tweet?
You have moments of satisfaction, and you make the most of those moments of the successes. Sometimes you have positive stories, you have a win, you get aid to somebody, you help save somebody's life, get them to hospital. You really feel elated, and you make the most of that because you know in an hour's time something so awful is going to have happened. That feeling will be gone.
At the same time that Jamila was tweeting about the Rohingya people in Myanmar, a certain American billionaire had also begun to notice the potential of Twitter's raw, unfiltered directness.
What made it so successful was that people were like, wow, this guy's a billionaire businessman, but he's out there tweeting about the Oscars or complaining about Geico commercials, or he's talking about the Ghostbusters remake. Like, these were things that most people would not think Donald Trump would talk about or have any interest in. It was unpredictable. You were able to get a much bigger audience than you would have typically gotten if you were to do this very straightforward businessman type deal that they were kind of doing before this.
Justin McConney is the man who really got Donald Trump into Twitter. In 2011, just 3 years out of college, he became the Trump Organization's first director of social media. And his pitch tapped into what was his boss's now familiar desire to bypass the mainstream media.
I said, look, I want to get you involved with Twitter, with YouTube. I want you to be actually involved through the whole process. You are going to be involved with all the tweets. I'm going to show you the responses. At this point in time, Trump himself did not actually use Twitter. I'm not sure how much he even used a computer. So in these early days, I would actually have to print out the responses to his tweets on paper, and he would look at them, and he would actually take a Sharpie and mark off the ones he wanted to retweet and respond to.
Despite the Sharpies, businessman Trump was still skeptical about the platform's real value. But that all changed after a night out in New York with another presidential hopeful.
Back in the summer of 2011, him and Sarah Palin went out to eat pizza, and he used a fork and knife to eat pizza, and the media was making such a big deal about this, and nobody had gotten the answer from him yet on why he used a fork and knife to eat pizza. So I had gone into his office. I said, Mr. Trump, would you want to answer in this video blog that we could post to YouTube and Twitter why you ate pizza with a fork and knife? Everyone wants to know. And he goes, all right, sure. He does it. We post it. We end up getting coverage everywhere. It's running on The Daily Show on Comedy Central. The local news networks are picking it up. And the next day, he calls me into his office. He goes, I have to tell you, that was amazing. I've never seen anything like that. He goes, it was on every TV station. Are you telling me if we continue to do this, that this is going to be the end result? And I said, yes, you don't have to go and have 20 different reporters coming in here and 20 different camera crews or having PR people reach out. You can just post something to Twitter and it will get you earned media. That was really the whole basis of changing his Twitter around. He got so into Twitter, he would call me late at night, like, I'm like, hey, I want to tweet this out. He would start calling me on the weekends. 6 a.m. on a Saturday, I would get a phone call. I knew once I heard that phone call. The first time, you know, you get a phone call 6 a.m, you're like, oh my God, is this some kind of family emergency?
Right, right.
As soon as I realized, no, it's Donald Trump calling me. And if someone had mentioned him on TV, he immediately wanted to respond to it. And I remember I had this discussion with him once. We were traveling to Florida, and he goes, which iPhone do you have? This might have been, this is 2012, so maybe it was the iPhone 4. Mm-hmm. He starts going, what do you think's better, the iPhone or the Android? And he goes, he started to mention that he preferred the Android at that point because the screen was bigger. So I started to get the hint that he was trying to do this himself, but I still refused to believe that he was actually ever going to tweet himself. I remember the first time he tweeted himself. It was like, I came in one morning, and there was a tweet, I believe it was late at night, and I had emailed the few people that had access to this account. I'm like, I didn't send this out, did you? And each person was like, no. And I remember I went and saw him, like, did you send out this tweet? And he's like, yeah, I started to do it on my own.
That casual, direct, almost random tweeting certainly worked for Donald Trump, the businessman. But how would it pan out when he decided to go for real power, a run for the White House?
He's going to run for president. do we have to change your social media strategy around? And the small campaign of amount of people he had in his campaign at that point wanted to change it around. They wanted a very much by the numbers social media strategy for a politician. And I said, you know, I really don't think we should change anything. Because he would ask me, he goes, do you think if what we've been doing the past few years will work for a presidential run? And do you think it can replace commercials? You do a video online that's funnier and humorous, and there's something that makes it newsworthy, and they run it as part of a news program, and then spend 10 minutes discussing it. That's way more powerful than doing a TV ad.
Trump has continued into the White House with the same blunt, provocative style. And even his opponents, such as Obama's former social media lead, Caleb Gardner, acknowledge that he's become a master of the platform. Though that comes with a caveat.
I give him credit for taking the platform somewhat to its logical conclusion, taking advantage of a lot of the negative trends of social media and Twitter especially. Those are trends like being able to get only the news that you want to hear, even bullying, which has been a problem that Twitter has tried to deal with the last few years, having at the top of our news cycle, you know, maybe the bully in chief does not help. What I will say is that I think it's a short-term strategy. There's only so much air time people can allow in their public consciousness for all of the infighting of a news cycle before they tune out completely. And I mean that on both sides of the aisle. And you're seeing that in a lot of the social media behavior of the users in the United States, where people are starting to tune out of social media, at least public social media, altogether, and retreat into more private spaces where they can have conversations with people they trust instead of being involved in kind of the daily garbage fire of our social media accounts now.
And it may be that some of Trump's apparent success on Twitter is less to do with his fiery style and more because of the presence of bots on the platform. Computer algorithms that automatically retweet his comments, creating a false sense of popularity. Christian Fuchs at the University of Westminster.
In one of the television debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, 36% of the pro-Trump tweets were actually generated by bots.
Yeah? And what was the effect of that, in your opinion?
Well, the effect is that it undermines political communication in the public sphere because it becomes difficult or impossible to discern what is communicated by a human being and what is being communicated by a machine. If a message has like 10,000 retweets, people really look at it. And it also shows up higher in top results. Yeah? People look at it and think, oh, this must really be important. Why did so many people retweet it? Yeah? But if 70% of it was retweeted by bots, then it's not really attention or positive agreement giving by a human being.
And according to Alexander Tavallera, professor of management at Swansea University, those bots may have even unduly affected the outcome of the 2016 US presidential election.
We did some modeling and we found some, let's say, marginal effect.
I think you said in your paper that maybe something like 3 or 3.6, 4% of the actual Trump vote, for example, could be seen as being influenced by bots. Is that right?
Yes, the difference is exactly, you know, the figures that you've just mentioned.
So if there weren't any bots, Trump would have got 3.62 percentage points fewer votes than he did.
Yes, so that's what we found based on our modeling. Yeah.
Would that have made a difference to his winning?
We know that margins were quite also narrow, and we don't say we don't make any mistakes, but let's say there is possibility for this outcome as well.
This is serious stuff. If bots on Twitter have the power to influence votes, that's a big deal for democracy. Alexander Tavallera found a similar pattern in Britain's Brexit referendum. So clearly it would be good to know who is real on the platform and who, or I guess what, is just an algorithm. Nick Pickles, senior strategist for public policy at Twitter.
Many of the assessments that are made about bots and is an account a bot are done using only the information that you yourself as a Twitter user can see. Now, we as a company have access to far more information, which we treat very carefully, and so we don't make public to even to researchers. And so we can look at an account and go, this person is a real person, they're using the account, but they may be very, very enthusiastic about politics. So to someone counting, oh, this person's tweeted so many times a day, they must be a bot. That kind of process has been not hugely helpful, I think, to public conversation. There was one pretty remarkable example earlier in the year where someone who had a night security job, who tweeted a lot about politics, was identified as a Russian bot by some researchers and turned out to be a genuine security guard who actually went to his local newspaper to defend himself, saying, you know, I'm not a Russian bot, I just work night shifts, which is why the times of day that I tweet are different to people who are in office jobs. So every week we challenge between 8 and 10 million accounts to check, based on their behaviour, that they are not malicious automated accounts. And we are taking a range of steps to make it much, much harder for people to operate accounts like that.
We've recently introduced...
It might be that we don't let you tweet until you pass a simple recapture test. You're given a box, a tick that says, I'm not a robot, and you have to press the box. That can range up to more complex tests where we might ask for a phone number that we verify. We might verify an email address. Or we might say that, for example, we give you a timeout on the platform because your activity has been too elevated. Or we might remove your account entirely because even though you're a real person in some cases, you might be doing something on Twitter that's against our rules. For example, repeatedly tweeting about a hashtag which constitutes spam.
So why not just ask everyone who opens an account on Twitter to prove they're real? Well, because that would instantly put an end to the power of Twitter that so many people value, the ability to challenge oppressive regimes.
We've all seen accounts from around the world who are tweeting, and if they were to use their real identity, they would be at risk of real-world harm. The account Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, for example, was tweeting out from within Raqqa the horrors of what was happening under Daesh. That account couldn't have used a real name. There's individuals who practice religions, who have perhaps a gender identity or a political viewpoint that aren't tolerated where they are. And so for those users, the ability to not use their own name is of critical importance for them to actually express themselves.
For all the stated support of free speech, there are clear tensions in how Twitter chooses to organise the platform now. The only real regulation is whatever Twitter itself decides. And that might not be enough to protect the integrity of such a significant public space. Jamila Hanan.
It's uncomfortable knowing that an increasing amount of the shares are held by a Saudi. You wonder if they might have some influence and might at some point try and start using information for malicious purposes. So that's a concern. But other than that, it's not a problem. As long as it remains a free platform and there's no manipulation, then all's good. If at any point that changes, then it's going to be a major concern and people will be looking for an alternative. And at the moment, there isn't one.
You do have to feel a bit sorry for Twitter. It didn't set itself up to be such a potent part of our political discussion. It's just a private company that kind of accidentally ended up there. But that still worries British political journalist Julia Hartley Brewer.
Although Twitter is a private company, it is nevertheless, for all intents and purposes, a monopoly in the same way that Facebook is and Google is in terms of how they operate. In which case, if they are individually, the people working in those companies are able to say who can and can't speak on those forums and what they can and can't say, I think we're in very dangerous territory because it, to all intents and purposes, it is a public forum. And I'm not entirely sure I want a bunch of 25-year-olds in their Levi's and trendy T-shirts telling people what they can and can't say and who can and can't say it.
And even avid users of the platform, such as Caleb Gardner, who achieved real political success for his boss Barack Obama by using it, are concerned about its effect on democracy.
I think the platforms have changed so much in the last few years that they've become undemocratic in a lot of ways. I think that has to do with how they've prioritized algorithms and delivering people information that they want to hear, not necessarily what they need to hear. It's tribalism in a lot of ways because of how, you know, the algorithms work. We tend to see the things that are shared more in our news feeds rather than the things that are important.
And what effect do you think that's had on political debate?
You used to be able to let your policy decisions drive your communication and prove that good governance in and of itself mattered. And I think that now communicating about that good governance in an authentic way in the middle of kind of a news cycle that is insanely driven by online debate matters, because otherwise you will let the story about that policy drive its actual output.
Twitter itself is very aware of concerns that, although it's a private commercial operation, it's become the custodian of two important functions in public life. It's now a primary disseminator of news, and it's also a significant arena for public debate. And now it's trying to do something about it. Nick Pickles, its senior strategist for public policy.
The current metrics that we focus on online are things like, you say, like retweets, like the number of friends you have or the number of followers a page has. And one of the things that we think is important is moving beyond those metrics. We think the metrics are going to be different because the way that they incentivize behavior might not incentivize behavior that serves the public conversation and drives a healthy conversation. So measuring how often do people interact with people outside of their own community? How often do people share information from sources outside of their own current information system? Those kinds of metrics, looking at the broader conversational health rather than just looking at the engagement metrics that we're familiar with today. I think that kind of contrast is a good illustration of where the future of measuring healthy conversation may lie.
I'm quite encouraged by this. It feels like Twitter is consciously trying to push itself into a new role. Tighter regulation and the reforms Twitter is considering could be the answer. But I can't help thinking that we users also have a role. After all, we're the ones tweeting and retweeting, and we're the people who vote. Maybe, as well as blaming those T-shirted 20-somethings in Silicon Valley for the woes of our public life, we should also re-engage with what democracy is really about. Taking difficult decisions based on complicated information, and standing by what we believe. If we could pull that off, it would definitely be something worth tweeting about.